Peter Atwater is the president of Financial Insights and adjunct professor of economics at William & Mary. He's also the author of the book, The Confidence Map. As a pioneer in behavioral economics, I often find myself turning to him to understand how social mood is influencing the economy and markets. In this conversation, we explore the hidden role of confidence in the choices we make and why events described as being unprecedented are often entirely predictable if we know what to look for. You learn how to spot opportunities, avoid psychological traps, and navigate the road ahead with clarity and confidence. Peter, reading your book, I realized that how I think about confidence is all wrong. In my head, I'm confusing it with self-esteem, how I feel about myself. The focus is inward. So let's just start by clarifying the distinction between what constitutes confidence and what doesn't.
So I had the same confusion when I started looking at all of this, Jawad. And what I realized is that confidence is more our relationship with the outside world as opposed to our own feelings about ourselves, which is self-esteem, self-confidence. And in trying to sort through everything, I settled on two feelings that were critical in order for us to feel confident. One was a feeling of certainty, that things feel predictable, that we know what's coming. And the other is a sense of control. And I would say that, you know, that we feel prepared for what's coming, that we've trained, we've rehearsed, we know what to do in this future that we imagine. Knowing that the road ahead is straight is wonderful, but if you don't know how to drive the car, you're not going to feel confident when you get in the driver's seat. So certainty and control are those feelings are vital for us to feel confident.
I thought confidence is something you work on and arrive at. So now, after many years of effort, I finally feel like I'm a confident person, which has this underlying assumption that now I will always be this way. I've cracked it. But it's helpful to know that confidence is not a steady state. It's a feeling. When we have it, we don't keep it forever. We move around four specific quadrants you have identified. What's the confidence map?
So what I discovered, Jawad, is exactly that, that confidence is a moment in time, but that we experience a much broader range of emotions. And to get inside of that, what I did was to take certainty and control and to look at them in different levels of amount, high and low certainty, high and low control. And from that, I created a four-box chart. Think of certainty on the x-axis, control on the y-axis. And in the upper right-hand box is what I call the comfort zone. And I call it that because truly we are relaxed, we're at ease, things are effortless, time flies. When I talk to athletes, they describe it when they're in the zone, that's where they are. And we like that. And we're nice to each other, we're generous. There are lots of stories and behaviors that are unique to that environment. The opposite environment of that, the lower left-hand corner, is what I call the stress center, where we feel things are uncertain and we have a sense of powerlessness. And the consequence of that is we're anxious. There's a problem to solve. Something is wrong. And with that comes, we're mean to ourselves. We're mean to others. We're impatient. We're irritated. We're irritable. We're stingy. There's a whole lot of not good things that arise from that environment. The other two environments are hybrid environments that we don't pay much attention to, but we spend an awful lot of our time in these. The lower right-hand box is what I call the passenger center, or the passenger seat. This is where we have certainty but no control. Think of it as being the passenger on an airplane or in a car. It also defines a prison. So you can get a sense that sometimes it's a good feeling, sometimes it's a bad feeling. And what's important in that environment is that the level of certainty that we have is very, very high. So if you think about Boeing and the problems it's facing, Boeing at its core is in the certainty business. And so it needs to be offering those in the passenger seat extraordinary certainty for us to board a plane. The last box is the launch pad. That's the upper left-hand box. And that's where we have control, but no certainty. It's where we make all our financial decisions, whether I'm lending money, borrowing money, this investing. These are decisions that we make where we don't know the outcome ultimately, whether it was good or bad. And the launch pad is an environment. We saw a lot of this during COVID, where corporations and business leaders are making these sudden, rash, big decisions, not knowing whether they would succeed or not.
You know, investors should be comfortable knowing that moments in the lower left corner of the quadrant, the stress center, are a natural part of life. We can and must expect them. But we are better served knowing we will make mistakes and there will be crises ahead. You argue for a vulnerability first mindset. Can you explain what that means?
When we're in the lower left-hand corner, particularly the very bottom of it, we're amid a crisis, our mind naturally turns to the problem at hand, the building that's on fire, the investment that's gone bad. And what we fail to appreciate is that every crisis is really two in one. There is the specific problem that we need to resolve, but there are also the feelings that accompany that problem. And I argue in the book that addressing the feelings is as if not more important than addressing the problem itself. Because if we're going to regain confidence, we need to change our feelings. And it's not always intuitive that solving the problem addresses the feelings. You know, just because Boeing landed the planes after the Max Jet series doesn't mean we felt better about the plane and felt more confident. On the other hand, if you look at the decisions that were made around 9/11 to ground all the airplanes, suddenly vulnerability had been eliminated. And so unknowingly, when those decisions were made, they put the feelings first and took dramatic actions that then reflected that.
On the opposite spectrum, in the comfort zone, we boldly take our greatest risks, expecting the most favorable outcomes while paying the least attention to the potential dangers. The further we move towards the upper right corner of the quadrant, the more extreme those behaviors become. What are some signs of extreme confidence?
The signs of extreme confidence are somewhat cognitive. We don't think because we don't have to. We don't pay very much attention to what we're doing. We tend to be impulsive, highly emotional. There's no reason to be attentive to scrutinize because everything is easy. And so we need to be as disciplined in the comfort zone when we're making decisions as we are in the other boxes, to be deliberate, to take our time, to appreciate that when we're in the comfort zone, it's our feelings are likely to persuade us to find the quick and easy solution and not to really understand the problem that's at hand.
You advise, remember to give yourself more scrutiny in your highs and confidence and be kinder to yourself in your lows. What marks the top, whether for a market, a sports team, or a leader, is the extreme extrapolation of invulnerability. We believe we will stay unscathed forever. Not surprisingly, not only does our accompanying behavior look ridiculous in hindsight, it naturally sets up the precipitous collapse in confidence that follows thereafter. Here I'm thinking about the events of 2021. But how can investors counter invulnerability?
To counter invulnerability, we have to, I think, set in our minds way before it happens what that might look like. So think in your own life. If I'm feeling invulnerable, what are the kinds of things that I'm likely to do? I may be more generous than I should be. I may buy things that are extravagant or luxurious. I may not think about the longer term consequences. In fact, my entire perception of the world is this rosiness not only forever, but of increasing intensity. And so we need to appreciate that all of these elements are objective facts, even though they may feel subjective, but they're objective, and to step back and to say and determine up front, oh, these are things that I warned myself I would be doing when I was invulnerable. And now I need to reduce risk as opposed to take more risk, which is what I'm prone to do if I'm not careful.
But why is it difficult to follow the advice of, let's say, Annie Duke, the former professional poker player who said to think in bets?
It's difficult at both extremes because of our cognitive processing. At extreme highs in confidence, we don't think because we don't have to. Thinking in bets is slow. It's tedious. It's, you know, we want to get on with things. And we don't perceive risk. So what's the point of being prudent? At lows in confidence, we're already feeling overwhelmed. We're already overthinking. And the idea that we would impose yet another discipline is equally ridiculous to us. And so we're more likely to just be impulsive, to make the rash, dramatic decision that ultimately is as incorrect as the ones we would make at the top, not paying attention.
You're right. The higher the odds you assign to an outcome in the comfort zone or the stress center, the more likely it is that you will be wrong. We routinely overestimate the certainty of the outcomes we imagine, good and bad. As a result, we take too much and too little risk at precisely the wrong moments. The key insight for me from your book, Peter, was that anytime we feel certain about what lies ahead, we need to appreciate that this feeling of certainty reflects our own confidence level far more than it does the accuracy of our forecast for the future. The future is inherently unknown. It always was and always will be uncertain. What changes is our own conviction.
Yeah, and there's a lot in that. So let me try and unpack this and explain why I feel so strongly about this. So as you said, the future is inherently unknown. And when I was writing the book, talking to a psychologist, I got yelled at when I was suggesting we were perceiving or forecasting the future. And he said, Peter, we imagine it. He said, think of us almost like cartoonists from Disney. And I love that idea that anytime we're thinking about the future, we're forced to imagine it. And from that, it became very clear that our imagination is entirely a function of our own feelings, that it's a reflection of our mood more than anything else. And so when I'm imagining a really dark, catastrophic future, that's on me, not the future. And the same at the other extreme. You know, when I listen to all these ads that emphasize, you know, in these uncertain times, and they of course do it in that deep, you know, terrifying voice, what that's saying is we don't have confidence. The today is no more or no less uncertain than it ever was. Why those ads resonate and advertisers use them is because they know that's how we feel. But it's not on the future. It's not on the times. It's on us.
Let's apply this to markets. So in December 2021, you said that we were in a Tarantino market. While everyone is focused on the party going on in the front room, no one's paying attention to the fact that the star stock after stock is being taken out back for elimination. That was a great observation. Now you believe we are in a Monty Python market. What are you noticing?
So what I'm noticing is our ability to shake it off, you know, I'll use the Taylor Swift analogy. So there's this reluctance for investors to think pessimistically about what might be ahead. And so, you know, anytime there's a dip, the mindset is, well, we have to buy this because it's only going to go up. And this has been particularly the case in the Magnificent Seven, and now extremely the case in stocks like Nvidia. And what's so interesting to me about the market today versus 2021, so we talked about the, you know, the clear invulnerability that people felt 3 years ago, is that the bets that investors are making are very different. In 2021, we were betting on the unborn, these companies that had ideas but no products. And we saw that in the EV space. We really saw it in SPACs. I mean, SPACs to me were the ultimate, you know, unborn foal betting process, where we were gambling on the jockeys, not the horses themselves. This year, and beginning last year particularly, what I saw was that our bets are on the thoroughbreds. We're betting on the biggest, most tried and true companies out there. And even though the indexes have gone to new highs, I would say they've gone to new highs at the same time investors are feeling less invulnerable than they did 3 years ago. That if we didn't have these, you know, cap-weighted indices, it would feel much more like a second, you know, a lower high, not this new all-time record. Just because the mood is much more restrained.
This is how you explained it. Contrary to what the major indices suggest, the crowd's fixation on the Magnificent Seven indicates that investors have less confidence than 2 years ago. As confidence falls, we naturally become more discriminating, favoring familiarity, experience, and certainty over abstraction and possibility. The Magnificent Seven fit the bill, since they're household names. In other words, behind the scenes, what you're saying is cautiousness is rising. Investors are feeling vulnerable. You also believe that Disney, the owner of the happiest place on earth, as well as other entertainment properties, is a good stock proxy for American mood more broadly. What do you observe from Disney's share price and what it tells us about our mood for the future?
Yeah, in the work that I do, Jawad, I try to come up with proxies of mood for different groups. You know, if I want to know how the global elite feel, I'll look at LVMH. If I want to understand how, you know, those at the bottom feel, I might look at Dollar General or the relationship between, you know, Walmart and Nordstrom's. But I was challenged to come up with a good proxy for the average American's sentiment. You know, what does Main Street really feel like? And one of the reasons I was looking for it is that we've politicized so much of the normal surveys that I wanted something that looked through that noise. And the more I thought about it, the more Disney seemed like a really viable proxy. It's businesses, it's breadth of properties, ESPN to the theme parks. And it's at its core, it's in the happiness business. And so when we're happiest, it should be doing best. And I went back and did some historical analysis, and you could see similar patterns over time that, you know, in the turbulent 60s, Disney struggled versus, you know, in the 90s where it took off and mirrored our mood. So when I saw last fall that Bob Iger was coming under attack, and, you know, there's a Bloomberg cover has, you know, Iger lost his magic touch, where they dressed him up like Mickey Mouse and Fantasia. It became clear that there was a real coalescence on how bad mood at Disney was. At the same time, folks like Kyle Scanlon are talking about the vibe session. And I thought, this feels right together. It's sort of like, more recently, you know, farmers protesting at the same time corn and wheat prices are, you know, falling precipitously. Those sorts of relationships feel normal when you step back and think about how people behave.
None of this would suggest a roaring 20s comparison by any means, which is what we're hearing more and more of.
Yeah, I think that if there is a roaring 20s ahead, it is going to be a function of an adoption of AI among a retail crowd that sees the possibility, the efficiency, the savings, lifestyle savings that go along with it. I'm not saying that that's not possible, but we sure aren't there yet. This, as I said, this post-COVID change, it's hard to look at where we are today versus 3 years ago and say, this is, you know, happy days are here again.
You know, at least five firms have hiked NVIDIA's price targets this month. And you recently said that we've reached the blazing rally phase of NVIDIA's ascent. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, so the blazing rally phase was actually borrowing a headline. I will very frequently on Twitter capture those descriptors because they change in the life cycle of a stock. And so you'll see, particularly at the top, you know, references to blazing, relentless, you know, never ending, you know, that there's this extrapolation that begins to morph into the headlines. And I like that because that's indicating that we're reaching a crescendo. And I think the headlines certainly support that for NVIDIA. You know, again, not to say that it can't and won't go higher in the future, but for this point in the cycle, it feels like it's going to need a dramatic rest before it comes back.
Let's talk about the Super Bowl. It was the most watched television event in U.S. history, outpacing even the watching of the U.S. moon landing. And let's focus on the ads, right? In 1988, 3 months after Black Monday, broker Shearson Lehman Hutton bought a Super Bowl ad to assure customers it ceased program trading, which was then blamed for worsening the crash. Insurer John Hancock ran one urging financial prudence. Stocks were on the cusp of an epic bull market. Similarly, the 2009 game, dubbed the Dust Bowl Super Bowl in the middle of the global financial crisis, featured an ad for cash for gold. Next month, stocks bottomed. In 2022, the sporting event was dubbed the Crypto Bowl for all the ads featuring digital currency exchanges and brokers. Larry David starred as a misguided naysayer throughout history, turning down inventions like the wheel, the fork, coffee, and in the present day, crypto. The bubble burst. You know, you say the Super Bowl is one of those moments when you get to see what resonates with the crowd immediately, and as importantly, what doesn't. What did you learn from Super Bowl 2024?
So a lot. So let's step back and appreciate that its location in Las Vegas was picked right in earlier, you know, in 2021 amid the frenzy. So here we have a location that combines things that the NFL swore it would never consider, which was gambling. And so you think about the decision to put it there in the first place is an extraordinary confidence decision that we're gonna pretend that everything is good and nice, and we're all gonna come together and put it in a place that was once considered toxic. And then you have it in Las Vegas, which is also the ultimate K-shaped recovery location. I mean, you talk about a city that is a velvet rope, one after the other, where those at the top are steered one way and those at the bottom are steered another. And so you have that phenomenon, and it's entertainment, it's luxury, it's spectacle. So the location to me was a big element in all of this. And now we have Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. We have entertainment celebrity merging onto sports. And for the first time in a Super Bowl, we have an ad for a Broadway musical movie. So we're not trying to pitch ads to the Bud guys. We're pitching ads to these young women who are watching the game, not for the sport of it, but for the spectacle and celebrity of it. The ads to me were generally very light, fun, somewhat self-deprecating. The Dunkin' ad, you know, there were no some of the horrible, you know, the nationwide dead baby ad from the past. I mean, the ads that resonated were consistent, I think, with this generally high mood for those at the top.
It also appeared to me as though there was a lot less risk-taking. Like 60% of the ads were with celebrities. Humor was the preferred angle. You know, it was like brands were playing it safe.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift was Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2023. She cleaned up at the Grammys, taking home her fourth Album of the Year accolade. Her boyfriend won the Super Bowl 2 years in a row. Swiftonomics has become a term to explain her immense effect on economies. World leaders, including Canada, Justin Trudeau, have openly requested her to perform in their countries. Her Eras tour ends in August. Then there's Swiftposium, a half-joking tweet turned into an international academic symposium in Melbourne, attempting to explain just how she has become so powerful and influential. Swift-inspired classes are sweeping colleges across the country, including at NYU and Harvard. What do you make of it all?
Taylor Swift to me is the Beatlemania of this generation, with the same transcendence that the Beatles had right near a major peak in confidence. There's a resonance, a youthfulness, a fluidity across celebrity in all categories. You know, think, you know, the Beatles playing at Yankee Stadium and the associations that came with that. And just as with the Beatles, there are classes on campus focus on that experience as well today. So I think this is history rhyming beautifully. But I would also note, you know, go to Nashville and look at what a boom Nashville is experiencing that itself is an echo. Look at the price of live entertainment more broadly. That too is an echo. So there are things that are associated with Taylor Swift. I think of her almost as at the center point of this Venn diagram of celebrity and sports and music that, if history holds, we'll all move in terms of sentiment with her. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens to all these sports teams. Does their value ebb at the same time hers ultimately ebbs? Not wishing her or anybody ill, but one of the challenges with being Time Person of the Year or being a cultural icon is mood changes. And I think we forget that it wasn't all that long ago that Billie Eilish swept Taylor Swift in 2020, right before COVID hit. Eilish won the most Grammys of any artist since Christopher Cross in 1980, with Taylor Swift being the competition.
Beatlemania was in 1964, if I remember correctly, 2 years ahead of the go-go years top in the market, right? And now you could argue we've been in the YOLO market. At the same time, you also argue the fact that our narratives mirror our mood. In 1929, there was talk about stocks reaching a permanently higher plateau. And now in 2024, as rising economic confidence spreads, there's a belief of no landing. Why do you compare the two periods?
So I think the notion of no landing has an eerie sense of invulnerability to it, that there is nothing that can happen to this economy that's going to bring it down. And one of the things I saw last year was an interesting coincidence between the phrase no landing and the term Bidenomics, which came out of nowhere last summer. And Bidenomics struck me as interesting because if I'm an administration, I only tie myself to the economy when it's at its very best, when there is the sense that it's proven as a as a measurable thing of value and of worth to voters. And so I thought it was kind of interesting that here we have Bidenomics and no landing, landing at the same time. They have similar feelings resulting in comparable narratives.
Foreign investors have fallen out of love with China. Asset managers once cheered on China's inclusion in global indices. They're now crafting products that leave it out. Investors on the mainland are traumatized and losing confidence. If we think about your confidence map, authoritarian regimes must move those it commands farther and farther into the lower right corner of the quadrant, the stress center. How then can the government lift the spirits of consumers and entrepreneurs?
So I look at policymakers as responding to mood. And their actions are often a lagging indicator as opposed to a leading indicator for the markets. If you look at what we did in COVID, if you look at what we did in the great financial crisis, policymakers were responding to a panicking crowd. I don't think they solved things or stopped the markets from bottoming. I think the markets were bottoming and they were responding at the same time. And I think the same thing is happening in China. The lower the market has gone there, the more extreme their behavior has become. I think it'll be interesting to see, Jawad, because that mood represents a broader population in China, whether we see President Xi tested in terms of his authority overall. Because the lower mood goes, the more likely we are to see rivals come to the fore. We could also see him do something dramatic with respect to Taiwan. He wouldn't be the first authoritarian leader to use a moment of low confidence to be aggressive. And so I think we are approaching, we may already have found the low, but I'm looking for behaviors that are outside of the market that suggest a low socially that is mirroring the low that we're seeing in the financial markets. That would affirm that, okay, the bottom is in. It's around here somewhere. It's either just taken place or is about to.
What I find interesting, Peter, is that in China, Fanhua, which translates to blossom, is the most popular television show right now. And it nostalgically recounts the halcyon days of a booming economy and financial markets in 1990s Shanghai. So what does that tell you? Like, is there a contrarian opportunity or a fundamental inconsistency? How do we distinguish?
I think those are very consistent. The notion of nostalgia and the glorification of prior periods of prosperity go hand in hand with Losin mode. So that to me is a fitting cultural message that we are, again, reaching lows where if I can't find confidence in the present, I'm going to find it from the past.
What are your thoughts on the upcoming US election? Age is featuring more prominently in media coverage now. In New York Times columnists with no medical credentials said President Biden showed signs of senescence and suggested he was sliding into dementia. The editorial board of the New York Times referred to this period as a dark moment for Mr. Biden's presidency. The Wall Street Journal produced a flood of incendiary columns with headlines like Biden too forgetful to prosecute and a tipping point in Biden's decline. Jon Stewart kicked off The Daily Show's election coverage with a wellness check on America's two chronologically challenged candidates. How do you perceive this?
Our perception of age reflects our own level of confidence. When we're confident, we look at elders as wise, as tested, resilient. We have a whole series of adjectives that are encouraging and excited about them and what they've accomplished. When confidence is low, they're feeble, they're losing their minds, they're weak, they're all of these pessimistic views that we associate. And I've been on record for some time saying that much of the 2024 election rests in our perception of age. And it's consistent with what I was anticipating, that age would become the critical factor. I think there is a very high probability that at least one of the two presumed candidates won't be on the ballot. It wouldn't surprise me if neither is on the ballot, because our feelings are changing and we're becoming much more conscious of their shortcomings, and we're attributing their shortcomings to age. That's the narrative is so easy for us to say, oh, it's because he's old.
That's brilliant. You know, the pandemic thrust all countries into the stress center. In response, governments drafted policies and prepared their citizens for the coming of net zero. They moved into launchpad. But we are now starting to see resistance is starting to mount. The deadlines to meet the pledged deep emissions cuts are being pushed out. What do you expect going forward?
I think climate change is an incredibly abstract concept to begin with. It defies a simple narrative, an easy definition. That we were then prepared to take that on suggests that it was an activity that only coincided with an extreme in confidence, that we would seek to tackle this highly abstract issue globally, simultaneously, says, it just echoes the us everywhere forever mindset at the top. As confidence falls, our behavior then turns to how do we solve the problems that arise because we didn't deal with the issue. And so one of the things that I've been encouraging folks to consider is opportunities in remediation, in repair, in big public infrastructure that is aimed at addressing the flooding, the consequences of global changing because we didn't deal with it. To be clear, I'm not suggesting a good or bad to climate change. What I know, though, is we go from abstract to concrete when confidence falls. And we're seeing the same thing in a lot of the diversity efforts. It's an ESG. It's all the same retreat from abstraction in my mind.
You know, you believe that events described as being unprecedented are often entirely predictable if we know what to look for. So what are you on the lookout for? What are you trying to imagine?
So I'm looking for events that mirror mood. So let me give you a couple of real-time examples. If we look around in the energy space, we are seeing, you know, natural gas prices back under $2 an MCF. If I'm Vladimir Putin, that's a problem. That is not what I would have wished for as a consequence of, you know, my invasion of Ukraine. So I would expect that we'll see heightened aggression on the part of Russia as a result of that, that the mood, the stories, the actions fit together. What we're seeing in Nigeria feels very consistent with, again, this low sentiment in the energy space. So I'm looking to see how does low mood across energy translate into things that people will go, you know, how did that happen? It's like, well, if I'm the leader of a commodity country, my mood is entirely a function of the price of that commodity. And so we're likely to see many dramatic changes. And so I think when we say things are unprecedented, we fail to appreciate the connection between feelings and actions. And once you look at that, very little is unprecedented.
My favorite line from your book, Peter, is this: success doesn't come from confidence, but rather from how we act and what we accomplish when we are without it. That feels like the story of my life, and it came as quite a relief.
I in reading your book and getting to know you, you have lived in all of the boxes repeatedly. And it's a message that I send to my students, which is stop trying to be confident. Be resilient. Know that you can navigate each of those four boxes, and you will navigate those four boxes over and over and over. And that in experiences in each of those boxes, we gain skills, and those skills are usable and repeatable. But I think the worst advice the self-help world gave people in general is this idea that to be confident, you must, to be successful, you must be confident. That's crap. As your life demonstrates, as mine, my children, as many others, success comes from what we do when we're without it. You know, do you move forward? Do you look for solutions? Do you ask for help? Do you take action to take control to regain certainty? Because if you do that, you will inevitably find your way to succeeding at your task.
In closing, I'd like to quote Khalil Gibran, who said, "You give but little when you give of your possessions. It is when you give of yourself that you truly give." Can you leave us with a note on volunteering, and why is it so important to you?
In the chapter on the stress center and managing crises, I put out a recommendation that feels very counterintuitive and some would say counterproductive, which is in the midst of a crisis, find an opportunity to volunteer. Volunteering proves to us that we have certainty and control in something. Moreover, when we do it with others, we gain a sense of community that reinforces that we have a broad sense of certainty and control in our lives, no matter what is happening in the background. And so rather than spending these moments worrying and being frustrated and overthinking, one of the best ways to put ourselves in the comfort zone is to go volunteer. And by doing that, we re-energize, we clear our heads, we enable ourselves to get back at the problem at hand with a fresh respect of ourselves and others in the process.
I think it's been well said that the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. Maybe it was Gandhi. But thank you, Peter, for sharing your time with us. I really enjoyed it.
I really appreciate it, Jawad. I am such a fan of what you do and how you think. This has been a joy for me as well.